This podcast is produced by Secure World Foundation, an endowed private operating foundation that promotes cooperative solutions for space sustainability and the peaceful uses of outer space. The podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial License. For more information, please visit swfound.org.
Okay. Good morning or good afternoon. Thank you all for coming here. My name is Leah Shanley, and I'm from the Collins Lab, the Science and Technology Innovation Program of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, which is here in D.C. in the Reagan Building. At the Collins Lab, we look at the research and policy challenges of mass collaboration as enabled by mobile, web, and sensor technologies, and what are the implications for government decision-making. You may be familiar with terms like crowdsource mapping, community remote sensing, citizen science, or even volunteer geographic information. So that's the kind of things we look at. For example, after Hurricane Sandy, grassroots groups emerged to use these approaches to help authorities locate missing people, get needed supplies to survivors, and to map affected areas. As UN SPIDER and UN OCHA are demonstrating, through their digital humanitarian network, satellite remote sensing can be very powerful when combined with these crowdsource approaches. And here in the U.S., several agencies like USGS, NOAA, NASA, EPA, State Department, USAID are beginning to pilot some of these kinds of projects in combination with satellite remote sensing. So for that reason, we're delighted by the opportunity to co-host this event with the Secure World Foundation, and going forward to help facilitate closer cooperation with the crowdsource mapping communities and the Earth observation communities. Now, we have an exciting agenda today and a great lineup of panelists. So with that, I'd like to hand it over to Tiffany.
Thank you, Leah. Can everybody hear me? Great. So thank you to all of you for coming today to this event. My name is Tiffany Chow. I'm a project manager with Secure World Foundation here in our DC office. And I will be the moderator for today's event on Earth observation satellite data sharing, policies, and partnerships. So hopefully you're in the right room. If not, a good time to leave. So just a little outline for the format of today's event. I'm going to start with a really brief introduction to Secure World Foundation for those who are not familiar with the work that we do, and then also give a summary of some of the activities that we do in the area of human and environmental security. And then hopefully by way of that brief introduction, you'll get an idea of why we're interested in this topic today and why we're co-hosting this event with the Wilson Center Commons Lab. Then we'll jump into the topic for today and some of the key questions that I hope we can get a chance to discuss with the panelists, but also with you, the audience. Then we'll go to the panelists' formal remarks. I ask each panelist to do about 10 to 15 minutes each, and then we can hopefully have a lot of time left for your questions and a more open-ended discussion. So real quick, who is Secure World Foundation? We are a private operating foundation dedicated to the secure and sustainable use of space for the benefit of Earth and all its peoples. We're a privately funded nonprofit, an international non-governmental organization, and been around for a little over 8 years. We do a lot of our work, sorry, let me get rid of this. We do a lot of our work through partnerships or liaising with international organizations, private sector, other civil society organizations like ourselves, space agencies, and all of the work that we do really focuses on promoting cooperative solutions to space sustainability. So space is critical for a whole range of daily applications and services. We all depend upon it on the day-to-day basis, whether you realize it or not. But there are a number of things that threaten our ability to depend upon space in the long run. And so those are the issues that we focus on as an organization. We work mostly at the decision maker or policy level. And one core area that we focus on is human and environmental security. So we believe that space is essential for meeting a lot of human and environmental security goals, whether that's bringing a lot to bear on sustainable development or climate change issues or disaster management. Many of the challenges that we face today can be addressed or partially addressed by space-derived information or services. So as an organization, we're asking how can we enable that and ensure that we're making the most of space in this area of human and environmental security now and also long into the future. The work is really grounded in the belief that access to space-derived data and information supports better decision-making in a lot of these issue areas. So to make it a little more concrete, some of the activities that we work on in this area of human and environmental security, for several years now we've been partnering with UN SPIDER, which is the United Nations Platform for Space-Based Information for Disaster Management and Emergency Response. We've been partnering with them over the past, I would say, 5 years to improve the use of and delivery of space-derived information during the disaster or emergency response cycle. So some of the events that we've hosted have tried to bring together both the space folks, but also the end users, the mapping community, but also the people who are responding on the ground. We hosted a simulation with the Polish fire department last year to sort of run through a crisis scenario and see how you could get space information down to them on the ground. Also, as of last year, we are an observer at the Group on Earth Observations, or GEO, which is the international organization in charge of coordinating Earth observations both from space and on Earth. And then we're also heavily involved in the space component of that, the Committee on Earth Observation Satellites, or COS, and specifically with their working group on capacity building and data democracy, or WGCAPD. WGCAPD is founded on this principle of data democracy, which is not just about data sharing and providing access to space-derived Earth observation data, but also improving the dissemination of that data and sharing software and tools to process that data and make it into useful information. And then also at the very end of the spectrum, working with underserved communities to build their capacity to receive that data and use it for in their daily jobs. Specifically, or recently, we hosted through WGCAPD, co-hosted a workshop in Nairobi. We took some 30-meter elevation data that was gathered on the space shuttle and delivered it to some East African countries, and also held a week-long workshop to train them on a range of open-source tools and software to use that data to do things like modeling for flash floods, which is a concern for that area of the world. So hopefully that gives you an idea of Secure World Foundation and what our interest is in this topic. And some of the activities that we're doing in this area. Well, let's move on to today's discussion. Some of the key questions that we hope will be addressed by the panelists and also by you is why share Earth observation satellite data? What's the benefit to sharing, to data sharing? But also, what are the challenges that exist? What are some of the lessons learned from previous initiatives that have looked at data sharing? Also, how is this handled within the U.S. government? What is sort of the USG policy take on Earth observation satellite data sharing? And then also at the international level, as I've already mentioned, there are several international initiatives already ongoing to try and improve coordination and cooperation amongst countries in this area. So what's sort of the status of that and some of the issues that are, I guess, plaguing that community as well? So with no further ado, I'll move on to the speakers. We have a great lineup, as Leah said. I'm not going to give lengthy introductions because you have their bios, so I'll just introduce them all and then we could just move through and then get to the questions. So first we'll hear from Dr. Mariel Borowitz. She's currently a research analyst at Space Foundation, but as of August she will be part of the faculty at the Sam Nunn School of International Affairs down at Georgia Tech. And then we will hear from Dr. Molly McCauley, who is Vice President for Research and a Senior Fellow at Resources for the Future. Then we'll go on to Dr. Martha Maiden, who is Program Executive for NASA's Earth Science Data Systems. And we'll, last but not least, of course, is Timothy Stryker, who is Chief of Policy, Plans, and Analysis for the U.S. Geological Survey's Land Remote Sensing Program. So, Mariel?
I'll just bring up a slide. Okay, can everyone hear me okay? All right, great. So as Tiffany mentioned, my name is Mariel Borowitz. I'm a research analyst at the Space Foundation. And as of August, I'll be moving down to Atlanta and joining the faculty at Georgia Tech and the School of International Affairs. Today I'm going to talk about some research on international cooperation and climate monitoring using satellites. I'm going to focus specifically on the incentives and barriers to data sharing. In this research, what I was really trying to do is understand why countries share data, share their Earth observation data in some cases and not others, and when they're developing their policies, what are really the most important arguments in determining which policy to go with? So as many people in this room probably already know, satellites are particularly useful for climate change. They have a global view, and they have a kind of unique vantage point that allows them to look at oceans, Arctic areas, and other sparsely populated zones that you really can't monitor as comprehensively using any other method. Satellites also use the same monitoring method over time and space, which allows for a great level of consistency. The table that you see on the left is a list of essential climate variables largely dependent on satellites. That was developed in support of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change to identify the data that's really required to support their work. And as you can see, there's a lot of different variables on that list. And what you can kind of get from that is it's not possible for any one nation on its own to collect all of the relevant data. So climate monitoring is really something that requires international cooperation, both in terms of coordinating who's going to collect what, but also cooperation in terms of actually sharing that data once it is collected. And so in my research, I really focus on the latter. Data sharing policies are generally written on the domestic agency level, so each agency within a country will have a policy on data sharing. But data can be shared down to the level of a particular instrument on a particular satellite. And so looking at all of the satellites and instruments that flew from 2000 to 2012, I try to look at how their data was shared. So what you can see from this chart is about 40% of that data is shared freely with no restrictions. Another 25% of the data is available for free but with some restrictions. So that can be either restrictions on access to the data or often it's restrictions on redistribution of the data. And I just want to point out that even at that relatively low level of restriction can really pose a challenge, particularly for climate studies. And you can imagine with the climate modeling where you need a lot of different data sets as inputs, if a lot of those require you to fill out special forms or apply for the data, or if many of them have restrictions on redistribution that make it difficult to either share the model or share the model results, that can really inhibit or slow your work. The remaining 35% of the data is much more difficult to access. So one of the first things I did in trying to understand why countries might share or not share their data is to look at the many studies and articles and reports that are out there that talk about this issue. And what I found is that among those different studies, people tend to look at why data should be shared or shouldn't or what countries have done in the past. And it really gives you this very broad range of potential arguments of why data sharing might be good for a country or why they might choose not to share data. But the thing that was really missing is what's the most important argument? Which things are really driving the development of policy and are really the things that are the decision points? So to answer that question, I went out and did a series of case studies. I looked at 7 different agencies in 3 countries, so the space and the meteorological agencies in the U.S., Europe, and Japan. I also did case studies of 2 international organizations, the World Meteorological Organization and the Group on Earth Observations. And those are the 2 that are really very active in issues of data sharing for satellites and Earth observation data. And in doing these case studies, what I really wanted to do is first to just get the information of how did the policies change over time, how did they develop, but then really get into what were the motivations for those changes. So why did they choose to change a policy, and when the policy changed, why did that country choose a particular policy over another one? So what you can see on this chart is kind of just a visual representation of how those data sharing policies changed over time across the 7 agencies that I looked at. And you can see there is kind of a pattern that is across all 3 countries, all 7 agencies. And basically what happens is in the very beginning, kind of 1980s or so, almost every single country had unofficial data sharing. So people could really access data and get it. There was some limitations on the actual technologies you could use to share the data. And also it was really a period of trying to understand what is the value of Earth observation satellites. What can we really use them for? How valuable are they going to be? And that period really showed that there is a lot of value in Earth observation satellites. It turned out there were a lot of uses, a lot of benefit from those satellites. And so the kind of next period that happens is countries trying to take that value of the satellites and that data and try to capture it in terms of revenue. And so every agency made some effort to kind of do that either through government cost recovery, where they actually, the government sells the data itself, or through commercialization, where they try to get it completely off the government books and have commercial industry take over, or through putting in place a tiered policy where maybe it's the data might be still free or near free for research users, but a charge would be, a higher price would be there for commercial users. So that happened a lot during the 90s, and then you see, particularly starting in the U.S. with NASA, countries started to move back to a more free and open policy. And partly that was just because of the experience that for a lot of countries, the effort to sell data really wasn't successful. They weren't able to make meaningful revenue selling the scientific data. And so they started to move back and share the data freely. And you can see that happened in the U.S. relatively early. In the last few years, in Europe, both agencies have done that. Japan has not moved to a free and open policy. And there's not a lot of indication that that's going to happen soon. Partly for them, they just moved their organizations. Now they're partly under the Ministry of Economics, Trade, and Industry, which has a particular interest in looking at these ideas of data sales. Okay, but the real question I wanted to get at is not just how did the policies change over time, but why did they change over time, and why did countries adopt particular policies at each stage? And what I really found over and over in all these different interviews and document analysis is there were three arguments that were really key to which policy a country chose at a particular time. Those were economic arguments, normative or moral arguments, and institutional or international arguments. So I'll kind of go through each one of these three. For the economic arguments, what you tend to see is that agency officials will argue for free and open data sharing. And the argument there tends to be that data has increasing returns to use. So unlike a lot of regular goods, the more you use data, the more people have access to it, the more you do with it, the more benefit you get overall. And so from an agency perspective, with NASA, for example, where their mission for the climate data is to do climate research, improve climate knowledge, the more people access that data, the better, and the better they can achieve their mission. From a legislative perspective, or for others who are interested in the budget overall, they're of course also interested in getting science done or achieving the mission, but they're also really concerned about the overall budget and how can you reduce pressure on the budget. So from their perspective, there tends to be a lot more interest in the possibility of data sales, or even of commercialization, just get that completely out of the government budget. The key uncertainties that really allowed you to go back and forth between these policies were first, is there a viable commercial market? So if you try to sell the data, are people going to buy it? Are enough people going to buy it that you can actually make meaningful revenues? And secondly, what's the elasticity of demand? So if you raise the price a little bit, will lots of people still use it, or will lots of people drop off and quit using that data? And then third, how do you quantify the benefits? So when you're gathering revenue, it's very easy to have a dollar amount and know what the benefit of the data sales were. But when you're doing research or you're supporting value-added products or all these other things, it can be much more difficult to kind of quantify what that benefit is. As you kind of saw on the previous slide, out of the experience of these different countries in trying different policies, a lot of these uncertainties are much less uncertain than they used to be. So in terms of a commercial market, many countries found that for most of the scientific data that they collect, there really isn't a viable commercial market for that data. You can't make meaningful revenues. In terms of elasticity of demand, they found that when you do increase the price, even by just a small amount, lots of people do stop using the data, particularly researchers. And conversely, when you make the data free, many more people start using the data. In terms of quantifying the benefits, I think this is still an area that's a challenge, but there's been a lot of really useful research that's been done with the data, so that's helped to kind of show that, and also a significant value-added sector that's really grown using that data. So based on that, those kind of lessons over time, I would argue that free and open data sharing really maximizes efficiency, and that commercial sales of that scientific data are really not viable. The one kind of other interesting issue that goes along with the economic argument is what you find in general that countries will do is they follow the rule of thumb that if you can sell it, you will sell it. So when it's possible to sell the data with high-resolution imagery data or synthetic aperture radar data, which are the two that kind of seem most likely to be viable, then countries will try to share it or sell it, either through a public-private partnership like you see in Europe or through data sales in the commercial sector like you see in the U.S. Okay, the second argument is the normative argument. And here, the difference is really more between the climate community and the weather community. So in the weather community, there's been a long-established agreement that there's a moral obligation to share data. So you can think about this like with hurricane warnings, right? The government, if it wanted to, could technically sell hurricane warnings. That would be possible. And people would probably be willing to pay a lot of money to know if a hurricane's going to come in their area, right? But the government never considers doing that because of the obvious moral implications. With climate, that's a lot less agreed upon. And one of the key uncertainties driving that is that the link between climate and loss of life and climate forecasting and preventing that loss of life is much less clear. So you can imagine, again, for weather, people understand very well how a hurricane causes loss of life and property, and they understand very well how good forecasts of hurricanes can prevent that loss of life. But those links are not as clear to the average public for climate. However, given that those links really are there, that data has that value, I would argue that there is a moral responsibility to share climate data similar to what we have in weather. And lastly, the institutional or international argument. This is, again, a difference you see in the weather community and the climate community. So in the weather community, it's really well established that you need to have international cooperation to adequately monitor weather. And that international cooperation has been around since about the mid-1800s when the telegraph was invented and it was possible to share data. That's when they started doing it, and that organization became the World Meteorological Organization and continues today, 150 years later. With climate, as you saw in one of the earlier slides, there is a lot of data that's needed, and it really is something that one country can't do by itself. So again, it's an area that requires international cooperation to really get adequate monitoring. However, the key uncertainties there are how much data is needed and which data exactly. Is there a priority in which data we really have to share or really have to collect? And how do we go about sharing that? What system should we use? And so I would argue in that area that what you really need for climate is an institutionalization of sharing, similar to what you saw in WMO Resolution 40, which is the resolution that laid out the essential weather data that countries need to share freely and openly. Okay, so then just to summarize, I think the steps forward here, knowing that those are the three main arguments, that economic, normative, and institutional, is to really build up the evidence in those areas. And that's the best way to really inform policy and make sure we make the best policies. So understanding how different policies affect economic efficiency, understanding better how climate impacts affect individuals and how forecasting can help mitigate problems, and also understanding better what the operational requirements are for monitoring climate. What data do we really have to have? And just to reiterate, free and open policies really maximize economic efficiency. There is a moral responsibility to share climate data similar to weather. There's a need to institutionalize climate data sharing similar to what's done in WMO Resolution 40. And I didn't talk a lot about GEO in my talk, but I did want to just say on my last bullet that GEO is really important, particularly for keeping the issue of data sharing very visible, and also for sharing this information about how the impact of different policies, how the different policies work and what effects occur. And with that, I am happy to take any questions. I think we're doing at the end of the panel. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Did you want to do questions now? Or? At the end, okay. Yeah. So you don't have a presentation, right?
Correct, yeah. Okay. Thanks. Well, good afternoon. I wanted to say at the outset that information is power, and information has value. And even when information is shared in some open way and it may be rather freely exchanged, it doesn't mean that it wasn't costless to obtain. And I think when we consider a secure world, we have to think about what part of the agency, by which I mean the community in this room, acting as agents on behalf of the greater good, the greater public, what part of the agency for scientific and economic change and disciplinary formation for secure world do we want to meet and balance? So let's suppose we're sharing information and there is perhaps an expectation of reciprocity in that activity. What reciprocity is desirable, which is separate from what's obtainable, and that's wholly separate from what's sustainable, given that these systems are not costless. And then in terms of access to data, there are access to data, plus the metadata that enables one to understand what one is looking at. There's the capacity, which is very heterogeneous across nations and entities supplying data with respect to validation and verification, so quality issues arise. There are differences in capacities to archive, curate, with respect to both hardware, software, and people. And then there are the usual interoperability and technical standards that enable different types of data to be pieced together for a more holistic understanding. So these are all components of a reciprocal exchange. They're not costless. So what would we desire for a security world? What would be obtainable? And then what is financially sustainable? There are a couple of other, so that's sort of a necessary condition. And if as agents of change we could as a community agree about reciprocal attributes, that's a necessary condition. But beyond that, there are a couple of sufficient conditions which would be required to make all this work. I think the climate case study is an interesting example. Climate as an application might be very different, though, from detailed information about carbon emissions or detailed information about timber stocks. If timber is one of your economically important sectors and you're Canada, it might be very different from the behavior of logging, where it's legal or where it's not legal. This is information. This is power. This is information about a region's natural resources, which have significant value. So additional things we have to think about that would make reciprocity sort of more, I think, viable and attainable. The first one I want to mention is innovation. In a world of reciprocal exchange of data, where are the on-ramps for new technology, new institution, new ways of doing business? Do we need to make sure perhaps that there's an on-ramp for innovation in the private sector? There's an on-ramp for developments in citizen science enabled by new hardware and new technology and very much a boots-on-the-ground public engagement in observing our natural resources and an environment. We also, I think, need to realize that, especially in the case of Earth observations, this is a community where there's a very healthy tension between new instruments for the pursuit of science, wholly new understanding, and there's a very strong desire to want to be the first to publish. And that's a good and healthy tension. Then there's also the case of once something is up and operating, there's the sense of continuity, especially for longitudinal studies over time of phenomenon, natural resources, environmental change, a continuity that doesn't easily admit innovation with a radical, perhaps, change in instrumentation or other orbiting or data collection characteristics. So how do we balance a very beautiful tendency to need to innovate with an appropriate on-ramp in a world of reciprocal exchange? Perhaps you saw a week ago Monday, there was an article in the newspaper. Thomson Reuters supports the University of Michigan to produce a consumer confidence survey and a subsequent index. And that index is released at a certain time periodically on a Monday morning, and it can govern a lot of investment behavior on Wall Street. There are clients of Thomson Reuters who pay an additional fee, and they get this index 2 seconds earlier. And the fee that they pay is rather significant, but it bespeaks the value of this information, especially with highly electronic instantaneous trading markets. Another example in a commenter to that wrote, "Can you imagine betting in the cosmos with data 2 seconds before the Big Bang hit?" Again, this is all the point that information has value. It's timeliness. Who has the first access to it? It's not unlike the desire as a scientist to want to be the first to publish and then perhaps share the data and make it available. This is a normal, natural, and healthy tension that I think we need to address. As well as this new technology about citizen science and new social architectures, where I think the Wilson Center and perhaps Secure World Foundation have such a large role to play, and you are playing it there and integrating that. the balancing the relative contributions of private companies, which often innovate in wholly new, quite interesting ways with lower cost capability or higher spatial, spectral, or temporal resolution, and then the traditional government underwritten approach. How do we balance that in a world of reciprocal data sharing? Social norms about reasonable expectation of privacy. We've heard about this all the time with respect to other information technologies. And again, the same can be true to greater or lesser extents as nations manage their stocks of natural and environmental resources. Crop production, timber I mentioned, carbon emissions, those are all examples where nations or regions or states or nation states or subnational entities perhaps don't want to share everything, at least perhaps not at first. This really can have financial and economic consequences about these resources. Next would be the value proposition of those who invest. That is, those of us in this room, we're the taxpayers and we're underwriting most of our Earth Observing Information Network. We need a value proposition to continue to justify investment in the technology, to justify investment in innovative technology. So I think a necessary condition and a sufficient condition is partly informed by the value proposition, which we must inform through all kinds of economic studies about the value of information. There's such a large literature that the health sector uses for the value of medical and health information. NIH uses it to inform its investments. USDA uses the same, the Energy Information Administration. All of these agencies for which their statutory mandate has a large information component, they're constantly being asked to bring the best technologies for understanding the value of information to bear in justifying further underwriting by the taxpaying public of these systems. I think it's particularly difficult in the case of Earth observations because you've got an information commodity, which, as you mentioned, once we have paid the investment to obtain it, the information is sort of there for all to use. But that said, it's also information about public goods of the environment. So we have, again, another type of tension between managing environmental and natural resources for the greater good, managing them for financially important sectors within a nation, for example, and then underwriting this complex infrastructure that we have. So we must close the loop and satisfy the value proposition, particularly in a world where reciprocity is deemed desirable. There have been some observers who've suggested the development, certainly in the United States, of a Bureau of Natural Resources and Environmental Data, a fully-fledged bureau not unlike the Bureau of Labor Statistics or the Bureau of Economic Analysis, but devoted to natural resources and environmental data. Others have taken that idea and suggested that it be a public-private partnership, because the private sector is so innovative, whether it's in weather data or certainly in remote sensing data for Earth observations. Some smaller steps that can be taken, and maybe Tim will speak to these, but if you've ever used some of the value of science bibliometric techniques, these are standard techniques where you set up an algorithm and it crawls through every publication in the gray literature, every conference presentation, every poster presentation, every transaction on Wall Street, and it's looking for who has used our data. And it's impossible to find because many users, for example, of Landsat data don't cite it in the conduct of what they're producing, whether it's a conference report, a peer-reviewed publication, or a poster presentation. And that leaves USGS and others sort of holding the bag of, we know a lot of people are downloading our data and we know they're using it and it's probably for extremely beneficial purposes, but it's very hard to track and monitor in the absence of a digital watermark or even asking users, please cite using these keywords, put them in the abstract, put them wherever these algorithms can find so we've got some registration of use and in what capacity one is using it. We cannot even use the most basic science of science tools in our community because we so poorly document, and that's a formal word, but we so poorly give citation or give credit to. Now, on the other hand, it is also the case that if the various federal sister agencies, and again, I'm speaking in the case of the United States, if they were to say that certain Earth observing data are essential to their mission, chances are they'd be asked to include some payment for it in their budget. So there's a penalty for speaking up about the value of the data, and there's a tendency to free ride because our budget systems are sort of lead to this set of incentives in here. But until as a community we work through the value proposition and how we can demonstrate it credibly And if we do indeed think these value are huge and tremendous, we need to be able to show that much better than we've done in the past. I think that will pave the way a lot more for sort of our desires of scientific change and be agents of change for this reciprocity, which I do agree is important for a secure world, but there are these additional complications which I think make a lot of sense, but as a community I think we can address them. So
great. Thank you. Go over to Dr. Maiden.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Molly. That both the former speakers.
Press the light should come on.
There you go.
I don't have a very loud voice. I'll pull it close.
Oh, can you pass that down to her?
Oh, you think I'm going to be able to work it from here? Let's see. Yes. So being part of the U.S. government, I thought I would start with the U.S. government policy for Earth observation data. It's been very well explained by Muriel of what's going on with that. But we have a essentially full and open and unrestricted policy in Circular OMB, Circular 130. A130. But in practice, we all, the large agencies with Earth observation data, do provide that data for free. I wanted to say something about the unrestricted part, though, because of what Molly talked about. We cannot require attribution, and our lawyers looked at that at the beginning of our data policy and thought that it was really more important for things to be unrestricted. And I think it's borne true that having data be free-flowing as a public use without restrictions is very important. We can ask for attribution, but we cannot require it. But many other groups, international groups do, have that as a stipulation, as you saw in Muriel's charts. Next. In the U.S., we've kind of emerged with a really very clear way of dividing what the U.S. government does and what the commercial sector does. So the commercial sector, you'll see at the bottom, has very high-resolution data. If they're going to fly satellites, that's how they get the business case of someone who's trying to do mining or real estate. They, you know, Landsat data is not that useful for them. Landsat data remains the staying power of a medium resolution instrument. And NASA's instruments are almost all even lower resolution than that. But the value-added industries of commercials can use that free data. They're taxpayers too, just like the researchers, to make value-added products and have a business. So when we talk as U.S. government members to international partners in the satellite data sharing realm, we try to talk about the value proposition for free and open and unrestricted data. And we can center on these kind of arguments that the cost of satellites dwarfs any small money, and why would you put something up for $1 billion and then put a crimp on the faucet of the data going out for a $50 fee? Doesn't really make that much sense when you know the good that can come of using the data, and it doesn't get used up. It can be reused. You give it away, you still have it. So I will say that reciprocity agreement that Molly brought up is one that gets us. I see some people in the audience, and Tim, we were recently in a U.S. European Union bilateral meeting, and the guy leading the European Union was a very stern person and was saying, well, what do you give me if I give you my satellite data? And I said, well, you know, we've been giving you data for decades. So we give and then we hope for reciprocity. And if you believe that free and open is the way to go, sometimes, you know, you are not receiving on the other end. It's been especially true with Japan recently. Muriel talked about WMO and mentioned GEO. I'm on the U.S. committee for data sharing, U.S. delegation, for data sharing on the for group on Earth observations. And I think this is a place where, more broadly, for sharing Earth observation data, the United States wants to make these kind of points. It's a ministerial group. It has more than 80 members. And even Secure World Foundation is down there to help. You can come and try to get on our task force and working group. We work really, really hard in the policy world. Those of you who are in it know how difficult it can be to get the exact wording that you try to get. And some of the European countries that still are have government commercial partnerships, such as France and Germany, Italy, have a difficult time assenting to a free and open data policy. So we are taking steps slowly. We started in 2005. So I thought I would move on to a little more about data sharing, because it's not only the policy, but especially if you have a free and open and unrestricted policy, it behooves you to spend a little money on your data system, because you're going to get a lot of people using those data. And I think, actually, conversely, one of the reasons why some of the other countries don't share their satellite data freely is because they haven't invested in the ground data systems and putting some kind of barriers in there helps them, because they don't have to have the kind of functionality that we really enjoy here in the United States. But looking here, we have a lot of data. If you look at the satellite data under arithmetic, some of our data, MODIS data, if any of you have heard that, it's huge. I'll show an image of it a little bit later, of one of the products. It's got more than 30 wavelengths that it collects under, and every day it's been doing that since for, I don't know, 12 years, there are two of them. So we have a lot of data in our data stores, and we have researchers, very sophisticated researchers, doing global studies that are trying to get that data. We focused a lot on getting the data to the research community in a way that they can use it with all of the metadata. But increasingly, we're being asked to share the data for policymakers, for, President Obama would like us to make big data available for, you know, my mother and father to be able to look at it. So there's a lot of pressure on us as government agents to work with the commercial sector and to use the new tools and to keep things information state of the art and getting the data to people. So this is our NASA data system. It's a system of systems, as they call it. There's many data centers across the country. They specialize in a certain discipline of earth science. You know, there's oceans and land and atmosphere. There's ozone and constituents. So those users, the data types are different. They come from different satellites, or their products made from multiple different satellites. And that is our architecture. And you see that we provide about 400 million files a year to our communities. It's a little more about NASA systems, if you're interested in going and looking at what satellite data looks like or how to order products. And then I wanted to mention the U.S. Global Change Research Program, which has started in 1990. Is a group of all of the U.S. agencies that work on global change issues. And together, they are trying to put together a system where such things like papers that are written of assessments that are going to be used for why is the sea ice, Arctic ice going away, those kinds of things, have a lineage capability. So instead of having someone have to crawl and find out things, to begin to really institutionalize the kind of metadata that allows you, and this is a state-of-the-art computer science PhD-worthy topics now being going into use here, to show, you see that diagram up there, who the author is, what data they used, and what sensor it came from, on what satellite, and those kinds of things are very helpful when you're trying to have an assessment that has policy information and implications. So lastly, let's see if this works. It does work. I'll show you MODIS Active Fires. It's one of 70 products from the MODIS sensor. It's been up since the first one was up, started collecting data in 2000, and then there was another one, second one in 2002. There are different times of the day. They give you a lot of coverage. And this product alone, I know, has saved billions of dollars because it's used all over the world by countries like South Africa, who help. They get the data, they can get it through direct downlink, or they can get it globally, and they use it to fight fires. So here's another case where the United States had wanted to charge money for such a product. It probably wouldn't be able to be used by countries like South Africa the way it is today. Okay, that's, I think, my last slide. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I'd really like to thank the Secure World Foundation for hosting us, Victoria, Tiffany, and Michelle, and all your work done in preparation for this meeting. It's always really good to come down here for these sessions midday, especially when you hear the four magical words that policy people like to hear, which is lunch will be provided. Very, very thankful for that as well, your generosity and hospitality. But as Molly has so well documented, there really is no such thing as a free lunch. So we're here talking about data availability, Earth observation satellite data. What's the best model? What's the best way to extract this value for our taxpayers and for the world? And so I think prior speakers here, Mariel, Molly, and Martha, have really done a great job in terms of outlining many of the economic and policy issues, value propositions, U.S. policies, international policies that we operate within. And USGS has really been a big beneficiary of the studies you have done, of our partnership with NASA in terms of the long Landsat program partnership and Landsat operations and science development. So I'll do my best to try to add something useful and informative. Not sure how much I can do at this point, and I'm sure you'll be eager to ask your questions in the panel. So I will try to move through this briefly. In terms of the overarching context and importance of Earth observations data, I think in the past decade or so, we really started to see kind of a mainstreaming of an understanding of the value of Earth observation satellite data, not just for science and research or even weather forecasting or disaster forecasting or response, but really for the entire kind of cycle of socioeconomic benefits. And the U.S. National Intelligence Council, for example, had done a study recently. It's one of these global trends studies where they look at future scenarios, you know, what the world will be like 15 years out. And the global scenarios 2030 recognized the importance of issues such as climate change, energy, food and water security, to stable governments, to successful decision making, and to, you know, happy people worldwide. So I think that's a very important development, along with many of the technological developments that we see related to big data and Earth observations that I'll address in just a moment. So I think from our point of view, USGS is very much in sync with our partner agencies, you know, NASA and NOAA, in terms of full and open, free and open data policy and the benefits that are derived from that. Even in limited budget environments like we have now, we're trying to maximize kind of innovation in our various Earth observing systems, whether they're space-based or non-space-based systems. And that's very important for us as a U.S. government in terms of declining budgets and dollars and where we're going to invest our money in the future. So we have been a long-standing participant and a real strong supporter of the the U.S. group on Earth observations that have been mentioned here previously, and the work being done to coordinate federal civil EO program activities, data management practices, and related interagency and international activities. So just a quick one-slide background for you on USGS if you're not too familiar with our work. See at the top here, we generate a lot of observations from space and elsewhere to support the science mission areas within our bureau, part of the Department of the Interior. So for climate and land use change, ecosystems, energy and mineral resources, environmental health, natural hazards, and water resources science. These are the themes we're trying to look at, questions we're trying to answer, both for our parent Department of the Interior as well as other external partners, federal, state, local, international, private sector, for a better understanding of how the Earth's surface is changing and what decisions we need to make, to safeguard society and to create a more productive, productive world. I have been asked to mention Landsat 8 in terms of new developments there. We're very, very pleased with the picture-perfect launch we had on February 11th that NASA provided to us. Thank you, Martha. And operations of Landsat 8 were transferred from NASA to USGS on May 30th. And that same day, we started making data publicly available from our Eros Data Center in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I do have information sheets on the Landsat program and Landsat 8 generally, if you'd like to learn more about it. But we thought this was a good example. For those of you in the back of the room, it may be difficult to see. But this shows changing lake levels in Iran over a lengthy period of time, from 1995 up through 2013. You can see the pressure and the draw on water resources in Iran. Also effects of drought and other environmental problems. And this is not an isolated incident. We saw evaporation of the Aral Sea I can't remember the country, I believe Kazakhstan or Uzbekistan, former Soviet Union. We've noted decreasing water levels in the U.S., Lake Mead, and other areas. Again, food and water security is going to be a critical, critical issue for society in the future. So the last image on the right is a Landsat 8 image, fully compatible, backward compatible with previous Landsat observations over time, which we found to be a very, very important component of our program and the benefits it can provide the science and research community. Just to quickly summarize for you here, the benefits we see with Landsat 8. We're now in our 41st year of imaging operations for Landsat overall, providing the longest uninterrupted record of global land surface observations worldwide. So we're getting more image data from this mission, 400 scenes a day baseline operations as opposed to 250 scenes a day for Landsat 7. The image data is better, higher quality, higher precision, more utility to the users. And we also have some new channels on this Landsat mission to provide information on better water column detection constituents, a Cirrus band to do better cloud screening, cloud detection, and an additional thermal band to improve accuracy of surface temperature measurements. Some of you may have seen this slide before. In previous discussions I've had with Muriel and others, I believe we've addressed this. But this, I think, in a one-slide visual can really show you the impact of the change in data policy that we experienced at USGS. When we went from charging for imagery to a free imagery policy on October 1st, 2008, you can see from the left to the right there the tremendous increase and number of scenes downloaded from the user community worldwide. We now give away more data in one day than we sold in our best year of data sales in previous years. And we don't see any decrease in the growth or the demand. We had initially thought perhaps there'll be a big spike and then the downloads will level off. But what we're finding is this insatiable hunger for data, even over longer and longer time spans, which I'll show you in just a minute. So Molly had mentioned the value proposition challenge and the attribution challenge. You know, it would be great if everyone who used these data attributed to USGS. That's not the case. And ways you might think to get people to do that, kind of a mandatory process, are just unworkable. So we suffer from a little bit less of good name recognition such as NASA. So oftentimes we're equated, Landsat's equated with NASA, which is well and good because NASA develops and launches and has been heavily involved in the system. But in terms of the political support, budget viability of our programs, it's very useful when we can get word out and have people understand where these data come from, how they were paid for, and how they're managed for the public. So we have taken some baby steps in terms of user demographics and user information. We do have a registration policy, at least now, at EROS for users. If you want to get Landsat data, you have to say, provide some very, very basic information, state your primary and secondary usage. And we've done surveys of users on some other components or attributes of the data. We have found, it's very difficult for you to see in the back of the room there, but the greatest use has been for land use and land cover change. Second is fire science. A third is education outreach at the university level, which was very interesting to us. We knew it was used, but we didn't know to what extent it was used. And it's likely being used a lot more now because it's freely available. Forest change and agriculture and water resources are the other major areas. So this shows you kind of a snapshot of the amount of data that has been given away. We also ask customers, how important is it that the data be freely available? And 73% of our customers said it's very important. 11% said it's somewhat important. So 84% of our users believe it's important the data be freely and openly available, which we think is a very important point of reference for us with our program. I mentioned there's been no decrease in the amount of data downloaded from Landsat, and we expect with Landsat 8 it's going to be continued strong user demand. But what's been interesting to us has been evidence of long-term longitudinal studies using Landsat data. Mm-hmm. So this chart here shows you the age of Landsat scenes downloaded, the amount of scenes downloaded by age. And obviously you can see, most recent data is most important. But there's also high usage for the earlier years, even going all the way back to, the first year of the satellite's mission operations. And we found that the reason users are doing this is, they're taking the data, they're making use of new computer data processing technologies, and they're crunching a lot of data, a lot of information, and they're doing long time series information products. You have visualization products like the time lapse products that Google Earth has done, where you can see visually on your desktop, on anyone's desktop, evidence of deforestation, glacial melt, mining operations, and urban development. The data, lots of data is downloaded in order to enable cloud clearing over over regions of the world where it's traditionally cloudy. So beyond the visualization and that immediate information that can be so useful in its own right, scientists are using long time series of data for more detailed studies and analysis of all these important changes that are occurring on the global land surface. And I think this is important to recall or understand that this is linked to the technology advancements that are going on in the world outside of the U.S. government. The big data revolution is not just the purview of the trade magazines anymore. We're reading about it in Foreign Affairs and the Washington Post. There are these massive computer clouds with enormous processing capacity, new software to link these clouds together, and vastly improved capacity to sort through all these data sets to get the portions of the data that are really needed to answer any particular research question. And that's generating all kinds of new understandings and information, both the private sector and the public sector. You see companies profiling customers and their customer needs. Those same principles are being applied to earth science data and information to show us what is occurring in our world and give us a better, more easy to understand package of information. So I think for us, the keys for USGS or other U.S. agencies, NASA, NOAA, others that operate these Earth observing systems. And it's very important for us to not only have the data freely available, but as Martha has done so much work in it, you know, to improve the discoverability of the data, you know, improve metadata, enable people to get the data that they need, hopefully ultimately in the future enable them just to come in and get the sub-portions of the data that they need so they don't need such massive communications links, pipelines, and take that data to drive more specific science into the future. Not just formulating a hypothesis and then trying to collect the data, but looking at how that data is already coming together to give us a better initial hypothesis to test and to show the results of. Molly, Muriel, and others have done a lot of these good studies. We have just kind of started our own initial baby steps, if you will, in terms of quantifying the economic value we've seen of Landsat data. And not ourselves. This is our federal advisory committee, the U.S. National Geospatial Advisory Committee, studying the annual productivity savings of Landsat data. The total initial, I would say, calculation of productivity savings, because, you know, as has been noted, we don't know the full story. There are likely many other applications out there that are driving value from the use of Landsat. But you know, these are the 10 major categories of user benefits. And by that committee's initial baseline calculation, we see at least $240 million a year in productivity savings using Landsat data, which, you add all that up, that far exceeds the cost of the system's development and ongoing operations. But we don't enable just Landsat data to be freely available over the web. We also have enabled many other data sets that we gather or that are gathered by our agency partners. This table here shows you all the different types of data that EROS is providing available freely over the Internet. The Landsat data sets are the green part of that bar. So you can see the other data sets, the MODIS data from NASA, the ASTER data from NASA, and Japan's METI. NOAA's AVHRR, NASA's EO-1 Hyperion hyperspectral data, commercial data sets, where the companies, are licensing them for our use or for broader public use in some instances. A vast majority of these data sets here, listed on this chart, are freely and openly available to the public from USGS. And in an eight-month time period, in this most recent eight-month time period, EROS has delivered more than 2,500 terabytes of data, which, by quick calculation, is about 245 times the text holdings of the Library of Congress. So, we're looking at a new age of this massive growth, exponential growth in access to the use of satellite data. And so, I think the only reasonable or the only, I guess, most productive conclusion you can come to, at least we have in the U.S. government, is that it's very difficult to spend dollars to chase after pennies for this type of service. We view Earth observation satellite data as a public utility, as a public good, something that really only delivers value through its maximum access and use, even outside the government. So I think there have been promising policy developments both in the U.S. and internationally. Some of these have already been spoken to and documented, but we feel the Landsat data policy has been very successful. The executive order on open data sharing and enabling technology advancements, the Big Earth Data Initiative for fiscal year 14, and promising international trends, the Global Earth Observation Systems data sharing principles. What we see to be occurring in Europe, we hope will formally occur in terms of the Copernicus and Sentinel missions policy of data availability. Hopefully that will be replicated elsewhere internationally. And this is something even being recognized at the UN level. The UN Secretary General's office has a new initiative called Global Pulse, which is attempting to link together these concepts of big data, shared research, and kind of integrated activities across the globe to solve particularly the Millennium Development Goals and those types of challenges. So we think there are a lot of positive trends in terms of freely and openly available data. Unfortunately, I guess my personal view is, many other satellite operators haven't come to that conclusion. We know there certainly can be a very useful and important commercial market. I think most of the data sets that the U.S. is operating or providing are not approaching that level of commercial precision. But, you know, we are seeing a great underutilization of these very expensive satellite assets by the user community worldwide, I think on the whole, because of some of these licensing restrictions and cost recovery mechanisms. So we hope things are moving in the right direction, and with that, complete my presentation. Thank you.
Could you finish the last line?
Oops, sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, yes. The last line was the...
Last one. Oh, very last.
Sorry, it's taking a little bit to get through to it.
Yeah.
Yes. So we believe the full value of satellite observations can only be realized...
No, I mean the very bottom.
The table's in the bottom corner.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes,
USGS.gov.
Yeah, the website is landsat.usgs.gov. You can get more information on the program, access data. You can even adopt a Landsat pixel if you'd like. Provide some in-situ verification for us.
All right.
Pardon?
Crowdsourcing? Yes. Thank you to all the panelists for their great presentations. Before I go to the audience, I'd like to ask the first question since I'm up here and I have the mic. It's great to hear that the U.S. Government agencies and the U.S. policy about this is fairly progressive. You mentioned that there's still a lot of work to be done. Not all countries or all the actors in this field feel the same way. But there are these great international trends, these international initiatives to try and coordinate better international cooperation in this area. I was hoping that many of you are either involved in those processes or follow them very closely. If you could talk a little bit more about what's going on at GEO, CIOS, with GEOS also, lots of acronyms, sort of the current status of those cooperation efforts, and what are some of the challenges to these initiatives. So anybody want to jump in first?
Well, I could say something about GEO. GEO really, I think that CIOS, and I think maybe Tim would agree with me, that CIOS is not really... working. The CIOS, the Committee on Earth Observation Satellites, 20 years ago did have data exchange principles both for research and for satellite monitoring for public benefit, but it was kind of got buried as the decades went on, and there's not really an active data policy discussion in CIOS, but CIOS, as are many other international organizations and also many countries and the ministerials, members of GEO, the Group on Earth Observations, and that really is where the U.S. is putting a lot of activity into data sharing. I'm on the U.S. delegation, and the lead for the U.S. delegation is a person many of you may know, Greg Withey, who worked as a senior government official both at NOAA and USGS before retiring, but he was instrumental in starting the Group on Earth Observations. And so that goes to show, I think he's working for USGS as the lead for the U.S. delegation. And, we only have carrots. In this kind of situation, you just try to make the arguments of why it's beneficial. And particularly Europe has advanced enough for their Earth observation data. The European Union has a non-commercial use policy, which is not free and open, but it is if you use any government money for collecting Earth observation data, you must make it available for non-commercial use. So it allows then that group to sell the data for commercial uses. So that's another part of the data policy that we have to try to be compatible with. But in my slide, I showed some of the kinds of carrots that we have. We created something called the Data Core, which are free and open for everyone, data to say, hey, you know, my data are in that core. Mm-hmm. But we have individual countries who have their own business models, and, you know, we're all just not on the same page. I think that we know that in the United States that having more data sharing and to better make policy decisions is essential as climate is changing, and that for our own security, we need to help these countries understand what's going on in their own country and how to deal with it.
Yeah, I would agree with Martha. I would just add that, you know, even in good economic times, it can be difficult for the government for any government to forego a certain revenue stream, no matter how small that may truly be in terms of its value, you know, for the agency to pay for other things. So especially kind of in the current economic times, you know, it can be a real challenge for governments to take this step. I think many of the people, at least in the space agencies that we speak with, kind of understand the value proposition for much of these data to be a public utility. And they've actually, you know, they're actually harvesting a lot of the same findings and information that that you all have started to provide. You know, there's a very good study that came out recently also by the European Association of Remote Sensing Companies. And I probably shouldn't stress in my remarks that private sector firms, companies that are gathering up these data to do new value-added information products, have also been very big supporters of the change in the Landsat data policy. And perhaps also, I think the land observations are probably the last to the party in terms of data availability and more open data policy, even in terms of understanding the, you know, the impact of land surface change to climate change. GCOS has recently documented very well, though, you know, it's terrestrial, the central climate variable. So we can see even within the land domain, you know, there's great value. So I think there's that knowledge there, you know, the political dynamics and the budget challenges in many governments, you know, are very, very significant. But we have seen leadership from the Brazilian Institute of Space Research, for example, European Space Agency has been another. That, you know, are hopefully moving things in the right direction. I think if there are, you know, a few other major data sets that will be used worldwide in the future, adopt a similar policy to what the U.S. has, I think that in itself is kind of going to be a game changer, because there's going to be that much more public utility data out there. And the commercial providers will move to the sectors where they're going to see the greatest returns, which is the very high resolution, perhaps rapid repeat data and information. Governments can purchase.
Molly or Mariel? Any?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess all I would add is just, like I said in my presentation, I think for, as an outsider, not part of GEO, I think one of the things that's really interesting about that organization, you can go on their website and read the statements, you know, just the list of every different country's statement. And one of the roles I think it plays that's really important is just the ability for countries to come on and say, here's our new policy, now we're making this data free, now we're making this data free, and really make the people who understand data sharing policies, who want to access that data, aware of that very quickly and aware of kind of what's happening with those policies. So I think that's a really important thing that you just don't see in any other organization for this topic.
Thank you. Are there any questions in the audience? Right here. Wait for the mic, please, and if you can introduce yourself and your affiliation before your question.
Marcia Smith, spacepolicyonline.com. I was really interested in your study, and I was curious, you showed this progression in the evolution of data policies for the U.S., Europe, and Japan, and I'm interested as to why you picked those countries and how different you think the results would have been if you included India, Russia, China, and the whole plethora of countries that would have settled.
Sure, yeah, it's a good question. So I chose them partly because they have data readily available, often in English, that I could access. But also they represent three of the countries that have very large Earth observation programs, and yet I think each one is almost half the size of the next, right? So you had a U.S., which kind of dominates the Earth observation system as a whole for the world, has a much, very large system by a lot. Europe, which is about on the same level as China and Russia, and then Japan, which is about on the same level of France or Germany on its own. So you kind of get these three different sizes to look at to see if that plays a role, three very different contexts in terms of the politics. That was one of the reasons I was surprised that there was so much similarity in what the translation was like in different countries, because they do have very different political contexts over time. I think definitely if you looked at Russia and China or India, you would find some things that were different. So I think, and I did talk to some people, I didn't do formal case studies of those. So it did seem like these same arguments, the economic arguments, the normative arguments, still come up there. But I think one thing you get is some anomalies. So I know in India, for example, there's a lot more concern about security issues, particular regional security and how that affects data sharing, much more than you hear about in Europe or Japan. And I think if you looked at even kind of developing countries, to talk to Argentina or Nigeria about their data sharing, then I think you might have some different things, too, where one of the things you argue is, people say is, you know, well, of course NASA shares data they can afford to, you know, but we're Argentina or we're South Africa and we just can't, you know. So, and, you know, you can debate whether those are really the reason that they share or not, but I think that you would get a little bit of different arguments, maybe some additional arguments. In the back.
Just wait a second for the mic. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Charles Miller with Next Gen Space. I was struck by the continual conversation, and I really enjoyed the insights, the data about the data sharing, and as you put free the amount of use and it's capturing that value. So society-wide, it's a big deal. And as a government program manager, you don't often have access to that, so I find that to be compelling. But in this time of deficit reduction and huge deficits, there's still, as I think Tim talked and maybe Mark talked, people constantly bring up, you know, getting someone to pay for the data to get another source. Have any comments? That's just one side of the equation. One, you know, get to pay for the data to cover the cost. Another way is lowering the cost of getting the same data. And there's recently been some legislation on the Hill, some testifying before the House Appropriations Subcommittee, before Frank Wolf's subcommittee, about commercial data purchase, which has been a long-term thread in U.S. policy discussions. Landsat data continuity was originally intended that. There's been laws on this, there's national space policy on that. Would anybody care to comment on their thinking on today's about use of commercial data purchase to get the same data but lower the cost of getting that data while, you know, maybe stimulating U.S. commercial industry for those who are U.S. civil servants?
Well, yeah, thank you, Charles. Yeah, that question is always there. I mean, we're not necessarily out of the woods in terms of long-term future data policy, data management. You know, in these austere times, there's that issue. How can we recruit some of these costs? I personally would argue that, you know, Landsat has been a very successful program despite its 40 years of changing data policy and kind of lack of consistency and certainty to, you know, how the data will continue to be provided. You know, the taxpayers have already paid for these data once. I don't see a need for them to pay for it again. Now, having said that, you know, there certainly are areas outside of the broader resolution, land, weather, climate information, that would speak to federal, state, local needs. Commercial providers can, you know, fill that market. I think most U.S. agencies, civil and military, have done some commercial data buys and procurements, and especially when the licensing arrangements are flexible so that, you know, we can get the most value and share them broadly with our users or with other federal agencies, you know, I think that can be very successful. But I would just come back to you know, saying that I can understand the interests and kind of, you know, this continued brainstorming to you know, do more to support industry or recover costs, but I don't think it would succeed. I think it would put us back to a very complicated place we've been in previously, and we wouldn't want to go.
Maybe I'll add something to that. I think, you know, my take on it would be exactly like Tim just said, that so for the first part of your question, why not try and sell the data and make some revenue back? I think the main answer to that over time has been it just doesn't work. So countries have tried to sell the data, it doesn't work. The second part of your question, which was about what about doing a commercial data buy instead of procuring a whole satellite, I think it's, you know, definitely an interesting idea. The one challenge with it is, if you're going to be committed to free and open data sharing, then you kind of put yourself in a position where you'll have one buyer for that satellite data, and then, you know, then the question is, do you really get savings because you have one buyer of the data stream versus one buyer of the satellite? So I think that's the challenge. But I think Molly brought up the idea that there can be maybe unique commercial partnerships or ways that you, you know, maybe use timeliness or some other factor to try to have some kind of partnership where you can have free and open data sharing, but look for some of these more efficient methods.
Let me just clarify. The government's still the buyer, you're just changing the acquisition strategy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then it can give away the data free and open just the same. No change in data policy, just a change in acquisition strategy to get lower cost access to data. The LDCM mm-hmm. costs $800 million. What would have it cost if it was on a data buy? It probably would have been less than $800 million, considering the maturity of our industry. So I was thinking it was an opportunity to save money for the U.S. taxpayer. The taxpayer, I agree, is paying one way or the other. It still gets to give away the data. Mm-hmm. That was my question. Mm-hmm.
Do the panelists have any feedback on that?
Well, with regard to your you know, looking at that approach, that is something that is under consideration. USGS and NASA have been asked to look at all options, any and all options, for how long to Landsat 8. And I think the key question in terms of that study, you know, in terms of ensuring a long-term supply of Landsat-type data that is fully compatible with previous Landsat missions. You know, the question of you know, how we procure this mission is still one that's open to consideration. And now, you know, the data policy and licensing is the big hook, the big issue. You know, we often stumble and trip on a data buy that really is not as fully and freely open and shareable as we think it may be. I think some foreign agencies out there have encountered this in some of their contracts, which actually may complicate their follow-on mission planning. So, you know, these are things that are all, you know, very much open to consideration, you know, by both our agencies.
And I'll just add one other factor in there is that, you know, we have had, the government uses commercial data right now. Really high resolution, we buy it. Under a policy, we were asked to buy it under a policy where it can be shared amongst our U.S. government agencies. So we pay a little more for it, and then we don't only buy it once for the whole U.S. government use. But, you know, one factor that would have to be really played out in order to purchase Landsat follow-on through this commercial means would be the calibration and validation kind of policy, because many times commercial data are pretty pictures, or you know, they're images that people use in for commercial purposes, and we need for our government research, these public policy reasons, to have the data be very precise and stable. So that would have to be something that was very fully explored in order for that to work.
Molly, did you have a...
Oh, that's okay.
Okay. Right here in the middle. Just wait a second for the mic.
Thank Darlene from University of Maryland. I wanted to address the security side of the coin. Dr. Borowitz, in your comments you mentioned the contrast of the U.S. policy of openness with that of Europe and Japan, I think came up in other remarks as well. I'm wondering if Tiffany or Tim, if you could talk about your experience working on the security side with Tim at the NRO, the National Reconnaissance Office, about the U.S. investment in satellite for security purposes, and if you could speak to the U.S., the openness of U.S. government, Yoshi satellite data that's procured on the security side with the national NRO funding. Maybe compare it to other countries.
Well, actually, in response to your question, I cannot say anything at all. but not seriousness in terms of some of the work that I've done, Chuck Woldridge here in the audience, others who are working in terms of the commercial licensing and the government-to-government discussions, consultations on commercial imagery. Every government has security considerations and concerns. The U.S. is no different, whether it's systems we operate ourselves or data that we procure commercially. So for the commercial providers, as Mark and others here in the room know, the U.S. government does license their operations in a manner to safeguard security. And other governments do the same thing. If you look at the German data policy, the Canadian data policy, German licensing laws and regulations, the Canadian licensing laws and regulations, the U.S. licensing laws and regulations, there's a recognition of that. Now, I think it varies worldwide, depending on country's own perception of its own national or regional security, what level of data they're comfortable sharing commercially or sharing internationally. I think we've benefited from years of satellite operations and applications. We've kind of moved along and allowed sharing of high-resolution imagery with very little restriction. Very little interruption in terms of the commercial transaction. Now, the commercial industry would argue not moving fast enough, and I can certainly understand that argument given technology developments worldwide. But I don't think the security considerations are unique to India, China, whomever.
I would agree, of course, and I think that some of the way that you can handle that is looking at the types of data that are being shared, the purposes that it's being used for, when you share. So you have the case of the disaster charter where maybe information isn't shared until it gets invoked during a certain situation. But I think all of it comes down to being very strategic and reasoning through the policy and sort of what is not being shared, what is being held close, and making sure that that policy is well-informed. Oftentimes we do a lot of work not looking at Earth, but looking at space for space situational awareness. And some of the information that's considered sensitive from a national security perspective, it's the policy's not completely well thought out. And some of the information that's not shared could be shared, and still things could be kept secure, and then it would definitely benefit the greater good of keeping space safe, keeping our satellites safe. So I think it's a matter of making really strategic and well thought out policy decisions about what you share and when. Anything else from the panel? Okay, other questions? Matt.
Thank you. Mambulaki, International Technology and Trade Associates. A couple weeks ago, I read that China has signed an official agreement with a number of countries, including Indonesia, Turkey, and Peru, to provide Earth observation data. And my immediate reaction was that this was another extension of Chinese soft power at play. And when we talk about motives, this made me sort of, over the discussion today, made me sort of think that perhaps some countries might perceive data sharing not just from a socioeconomic or from a monetary perspective, and I'm curious for your thoughts on this.
I would agree with you. I think it definitely is something that countries, like the example I said of when you NSC and GEO, the countries making their statements, they really try to emphasize that. I think that is seen as sharing your data is a good thing to do and something you really, you know, does bring some prestige or soft power to you. And China has been doing that with for a while with the China-Brazil Earth Resources Satellite. They share that data originally free with the partners and then free with all of Africa. And now I think anyone can access it. As I think they have used that in the past, and countries in general do really try to say, you know, look at this nice thing we're doing for the whole world, you know, that kind of brings some positive, you know, prestige or whatever back to them. I would agree with that. Anybody else?
Well, yeah, certainly that's an important element of a country's foreign policy, science and technology policy. I think the U.S. has practiced this for more than 40 years with our weather satellite program, with the Landsat program, and a number of international partnerships to share that data. And I believe, I would argue, you know, share it with very few strings attached. I think that's due to our fundamental U.S. belief that, you know, the value of this data and information isn't being fully and openly shared. It contributes to civil society, improved decision-making, security of populations, you know, better scientific and technological advancements. So, you know, all countries certainly do that. I think the U.S. does it from a particular perspective, and hopefully we'll continue to do it with few strings attached.
Martha, did you have something to add?
No.
Okay. right over here on the left.
My name is Mark Brender. I'm with the Digital Globe Foundation. At Digital Globe, the company, we worry about commercial providers. All the imagery that's collected by the U.S. government when it comes to data sharing from commercial providers like Digital Globe, Digital Globe collects 3 to 4 billion square kilometers a day at 19-inch ground resolution. All that imagery goes over to the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. And that agency is able to share all that data with all other federal agencies at zero cost. And in some cases, if a federal agency, for example, USAID, at State Department, has a project they're working on, say in Africa, with an NGO, they're allowed to share that data with the NGO in order to solve the problem that project is working on. And a word about the University of Maryland as far as the national security. Digital Globe collects imagery at half-meter ground resolution. And our operating license, our policy, we're restricted. If there's a threat to national security or foreign policy concern, then the U.S. government can impose what the media has called shutter control, where the government can come in and tell us not to image a certain location for a certain period of time. And to my knowledge, since the Iconos satellite was first launched in the late 90s, not once has the government knocked on the door of the commercial providers and asked for a restriction. Now, has the government bought all the imagery up, say over Afghanistan and Iraq, at the beginning of the Iraq war in Afghanistan? Yes, they bought up all the imagery, and they wouldn't let us sell it to anybody else, but it wasn't under the terms of our operating license. It was a business deal. But so far, the government's been very good about keeping their grimy fingerprints off our lens and letting us image where we need to image and letting us sell that imagery. The thing that commercial providers would like to do next is to be able to get permission to sell our best quality imagery, better than half meter or better than 19-inch ground resolution. I think those debates are beginning now.
Did I see a question over here in the front?
Xiao Chen, Bethesda, Maryland. I have a couple of questions. First one is this, to Dr. Grovitz or any other person on the panel. What's the sea temperature variation in last decade? And also, what are the variation of world temperature from various programs? And what's the entity to resolve the difference? And also, which entity will have a more reliable and accuracy world temperature?
It's a good question. I don't have the answers off the top of my head for the variation in sea surface temperature. I know, actually, what I would do is point you to NASA's climate change website. They have an excellent website in terms of showing both visually and numerically the sea surface temperature change, air temperature change over the last few decades. So I think if you go there, you'll be able to get really accurate answers.
Mm-hmm. And water temperature?
The same website.
Okay, mm-hmm. And the second one is to Martha or any other person. What's the Martian band of the U.S. in the U.S. data system?
What does NASA spend?
No, band. Band in the data.
Band.
B-A-N-D-S.
Yeah. Oh, what
wavelengths
do you image?
Oh, many, many. We have a lot of satellites up, and they're both active and passive. So we have radars and LIDARs as well as passive instruments, and we go all the way from very long microwaves all the way to the other side.
Maybe I rephrase my question.
Okay.
What's the band most used?
Most used.
In terms of data or?
Yeah, data.
I think they really vary depending upon the discipline that you're working in. Okay. So land folks, they like visual, but they use near-far infrared for, you know, water stress and those kinds of things. But if you're looking for water vapor or something, the microwave, the very long wavelengths are useful.
Okay, and to compensate, if we assess the closed data over the years, and how the data used in the forest management in the United States.
I'm sorry, your first question related to coastal data?
Yeah, we have a coastal data, and have we tried to see the difference over the years of those data?
In coastal?
The point I try to get is, did they show the land erosion?
Yes, there have been studies using data showing coastal erosion, particularly up in the Arctic area. You can see significant coastal erosion in Alaska, one area. I believe, may not just be Landsat imagery, but other imagery sources showing the incremental effects of sea level rise in the low-lying areas. I've seen projections of what Florida is going to look like in 40 years, and they're very good in real estate there. And the other one, your question was regarding forest information.
Forest management.
Yeah. The U.S. Forest Service uses a great deal of Landsat data, other moderate resolution data. They also utilize L-band synthetic aperture radar data. I'm not sure about MODIS for related vegetation. A number of applications to... and then kind of downstream science for USGS to look at the carbon sequestration capacity of the forests, of healthy forests in the United States. There's a related initiative through the group on Earth Observations in support of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, the Red Plus Program, the reduction of emissions for forest degradation, forest deforestation and degradation. An awful lot of Landsat imagery is being used in support of those types of assessments in terms of forest cover change. USAID, I believe, NASA, NOAA, and USGS are, and USDA, the Forest Service, are supporting capacity building for scientific assessments and better local understanding to support countries' national assessments, because it's important for the countries themselves to maintain the official records and the official information that kind of feeds into the UN system and could feed into future carbon exchange markets and carbon sequestration scenarios. So, yeah, Landsat data and many other optical and radar data sources are being used for, and high-resolution commercial data as well, for some of the targeted assessments of forest worldwide.
Thank you. Thank you for your questions. And we're running out of time, so again, I'm going to use my power as moderator to ask the closing question. Mm-hmm. For each of our panelists, we talked a lot about sort of the making the case, justifying these investments, especially since we can't charge or recoup a lot of these costs, and sort of the value proposition and communicating that effectively. And also we talked about the fact that there's amazing potential from this data, and oftentimes it's underutilized. We look a lot at sort of how you can get raise awareness about the data that's out there, that so much of it is freely available, and also capacity building to make use of that data. So for each of the panelists, if you have maybe one new idea or a strong case for something that we could be doing to raise awareness about these, the value of these, of data sharing of the Earth observation satellites that we put up there, and sort of, you know, a new outreach or marketing idea, for this.
Start on that end.
Wow. Now that's very interesting. You should have given it to us in advance.
Sorry.
We would have put our heads to it a little bit longer. I think that a lot of people are afraid of using satellite data. They're afraid of it because they think it's going to be too complicated. And we are getting better standards now to at least have out there the images of the data, the images of the products, even if they're not the full data. So one thing to do is to try to alert people that the satellite data are getting easier to use for many purposes.
Well, yeah, I would agree with Martha's recommendation. I might also look at you know, how the GPS market has evolved over time, and GPS being viewed as such an essential foundational commodity of all sorts of information decision-making. And people there don't necessarily understand how the GPS system operates. They don't care about interpreting the signal. You know, companies are doing that for them, value-added companies. And so I think it's important for us to emphasize that as technology is advancing, you should not have to be an expert to use remote sensing data. The data are there as part of a public utility model, something essential to the public. And I think it's up to us as agencies and perhaps hopefully also, you know, the academic experts to underscore, you know, the value in that way so that people start thinking of it as not something exotic, esoteric out there in space, but something that's, you know, part and parcel of their everyday decision.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay. So I guess I would, you know, I pay for my electricity and water, and those are public utilities. I think maybe it's more of a public information model where all of your points remain valid, but the public utility is a construct that can be, that could be misconstrued in ways that I know we don't intend. I think I reason a lot by analogy when I do my space policy work, as perhaps you do too. So I think about census data, which is the only, it's mandated by the Constitution that we will number the people. And the census data leverage huge transfers of wealth. They underpin cost of living adjustments by region of the nation, Medicare, Medicaid payments. They just leverage a tremendous amount of wealth, and I would assert that our Earth observation information does the same. There's a tremendous amount of health data, macroeconomic data about unemployment, oil, gas, all of our industrial sectors produce a lot of data. What I would say was markedly, strikingly different is if you're reading or using anything that has invoked census data or health data or BLS data, you know it because it's cited. And I would assert that when we're using some of our Earth observing data, you'll read something and you will not realize where it's coming from. So it leads to this huge underappreciation. I'm not arguing for attribution to the agency owning and operating it, so USGS or NASA. I'm arguing for attribution to, if not the instrument, then to the Earth observing network in some way, because it's there, it's almost like salt. If it's not there, you notice. If it's there, you know, it's really important. And we have failed as a community to urge some kind of acknowledgement of this very important information project. And then lastly, in terms of use of Earth observation data, it remains very difficult to use. There are DACs, data archive and distribution centers that the agencies run, but it is a very closed community. It's really, really hard to use traditional Earth observing data. That is not the case for citizen science data. We didn't talk much about that, although USGS has some phenomenal citizen science activities going on within your stewardship purview. And I think that is already a complement to, if not a substitute, for some types of Earth observing data. So the time will come where we either become very out of date in our old-fashioned way of providing satellite data, and we're just overtaken by alternative, more user-friendly methods, or the time will come when both communities are really working together for a much stronger, viable, exciting, in-your-face public good. And that's what I'm really hoping will happen, is that the communities merge.
Okay. So I would say definitely the issue of documenting the data use to really ensure that the investment in these systems is relative or equal to the benefits from the system is really important. But to me, in terms of ensuring more use of the data, increasing that use, I think one of the most interesting things about data is not just that it's a public good, but it's a really unique public good in the sense that it has that increasing returns to use. And I think you see that, for example, with the chart that Tim put up. You know, as more people use it, they think of new ways to use it and that grows, or more people see that it's been used and they start using it and it grows, or as additional countries make more data available or the Landsat record becomes longer, then it's more useful, that causes more use. And data has this really interesting characteristic that makes it kind of snowball in its use. And I think the more you can get people to use it, the more they will use it, is sort of this interesting thing that really is possible with data. So I think that really is already underway, and I think, you know, that's the thing, to really just get that data out there, increase the amount of data available, and I think people really will continue to use it.
Well, thank you, and going along with that on-the-spot question at the end there. But it sounds like, too, you know, the more that you can increase the use of it and the awareness of it, then the case for sharing it becomes even easier, too. Mm-hmm. So thank you to all of our panelists for their insights, and to the audience for your great questions and for being here. Please join me in thanking our panel, and have a great rest of the day.